Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times from These Football Times. And tonight we are going all things Spanish. I'm Stephen Scragg, by the way, and we have checked the studio or slash box rooms to make sure that there is no brick of a mobile phone knocking around that's been strapped to some kind of back of a chair or something. We're not expecting any porn soundtracks for our recording tonight, but you never know. In one corner, we have got the fantastic James Kelly returning tonight. How are we doing, James?
Yeah, doing very well, thanks. Yeah, Steve. Hopefully, like you say, nothing will befall us like it did the BBC the other night. But I can see a few boxes there behind Matthew, but hopefully there's nothing hidden in any of those. And we should, yeah, be all right to have, a very Spanish-themed evening.
Oh, most definitely. And yes, I'm going over to our opposite corner of our triangle tonight. We have the returning, the magnificent Matthew Gibbs. Matthew?
Hello, hello. That's a very nice welcome. We don't usually get welcomes like that. Get used to this.
Oh, no, we're always, always absolutely delighted to have you on, Matthew. You're always brilliant, brilliant value in all the podcasts we do. So we'll get straight into it. Our first topic tonight, we're moving to James, and James is going to bring us our first dose of La Liga. James, what's your opening gambit tonight?
Yeah, well, Steve, it basically just wanted to kind of just have a look at Sevilla a little bit and the season that they're having. Obviously, it's the sort of thing where it's a name that people who obviously know football or even don't really know football, Sevilla is always one of the teams that people kind of gravitate towards, I think, when you think of Spanish football. And it's just really how poorly their season is going. So they played Cadiz last night, and I watched the first, hour, sort of 70 minutes or so, and it wasn't particularly interesting. So I basically just went to make a cup of tea and then went to have a read because I thought, this isn't really going anywhere. In the end, they did win 1-0. Even Rakitic scored a penalty. But it was the sort of thing where it's not exactly a particularly... They didn't look very convincing, put it that way. And I mean, they kind of last season, I think sort of a year or so ago, you think last January, they were really pushing for, you know, the right end of La Liga, pushing Real, and obviously ended up finishing fourth and getting the Champions League. But it was a sort of a little bit of scraping in there. They had to hold on towards the end. And then just this season has just been a bit of a catastrophe, really. I think it's their worst league start in about 40 years. And I mean, they're currently 15th after winning last night. But you look at the table and, I mean, they're a point outside the relegation zone. That doesn't really count, one of those relegation spaces, because Elche have been so abhorrent this season. And I think it's just the sort of thing of, I think more broadly, it's interesting when you look at the signing strategy and the way things are going. You know, Sevilla have always been renowned, certainly the last 10, 15 years, for signing these players and really kind of, you know, having a long-term strategy. Obviously, Monchi is a name that we're all familiar with as sporting director. And I think it's interesting, you look at the way they are now, you know, the way the squad is constructed. If the last sort of month Isco ended up leaving, he'd only been there about 4 or 5 months. You had Lopetegui as the manager wanting to sign Isco. He brings him in. He then gets sacked. Sampaoli comes in. He doesn't play Isco. You know, this is a name that, even though latterly at Real, he wasn't really playing, he's a name that everybody knows, that's obviously got on his day an awful lot of quality. And just, you know, he's ended up cancelling his contract by mutual consent. Sevilla don't want him. You look, as I say, Rakitic scores the goal last night. Up front, you know, Rafa Mir and Enesri are not really doing the business. I think Enesri's, I don't know if he's gone, but he's in talks to join Nice. They're just not in a very good place. I just think it's very interesting. I think this kind of parallels with, you think back when sort of a decade or so ago, Villarreal got relegated the same season they were playing in the Champions League. And I think it's just a very interesting story, the way that, as I say, they've gone from challenging for La Liga and for the title less than a year ago to being in this position now where they're really fighting for their lives and they're really not in a good way at all.
I think Spanish football does have that kind of volatility to it. I remember Celta Vigo being relegated while playing Champions League football. I think they went up against Arsenal, and that's probably stretching about 20 years ago. You know, I think with, you know, even looking back to things like Atletico Madrid being relegated, I think it was 2000. There is a spectacular nature to teams of that kind of chasing pack behind. You know, obviously it's everything's Barcelona, Real Madrid, but then, you know, Atletico used to, you know, be such a watchword for, you know, being so dysfunctional. Is that there was that era of Sevilla from Juan de Ramos, basically. They became kind of like that next team, that next watchword, the third team, basically. You know, especially when kind of like Deportivo ebbed away from the glories of the early part of the millennium, and then Rafa Benitez is Valencia as well. You know, I think a lot of us, you know, equate Sevilla to kind of like being, I don't know, for some time, certainly, they were the way to run a football club in Spain. You know, they were a watchword of consistency. But, you know, I mean, if we're looking for kind of like, always try and draw parallels to the English game or the British game, but, you know, similarities to say like West Ham's struggles this season. You know, they seem to be a team with a lot of, I don't know, they have, you know, a lot of the right components, a lot of compelling components, and yet can't quite pull it together for whatever reason as a collective.
I think a lot of the issues is what James mentioned, is the transfer activity. They've sort of stepped away from, you know, they used to be very careful with the transfers. It was always about finding, you know, unearthed gems and the next big thing. And then I think as Real Madrid and Barcelona's powers waned a little bit in the last few years, and I think Sevilla saw a bit of an opportunity to sort of win now, like maybe even challenge for La Liga. And so they started to buy more experienced players like Papu Gomez and Lamela, and trying to bring in Martial last season. And Isco, I think, is like a really symbolic failure of this sort of, you know, win now transfer method. And Monchi, like famed sporting director, has not pulled it out of the bag in the last few years. I do think a lot of it is down to the, you know, the new La Liga wage restrictions, which really affect clubs affect all clubs that aren't Barcelona and Real Madrid, basically, because, you know, everyone's on really strict wage restrictions, meaning that they can't, unless they sell, they can't really bring in players. So I think they've made some real missteps in the transfer market. They've managed to assemble a squad that is like the slowest squad in Europe. There's no pace in there whatsoever. So there's all sorts of, you know, nice passing to get into a good position, but there's no one running behind. There's no pace, and there's nothing explosive. And I mean, they let Lucas Ocampos go in the summer and let him go to Ajax, which I didn't really understand. I think he's a pretty terrific player and really capable of pulling something out of nothing. So I think it's a failure in the transfer market that's got them here, really. I also think Jorge Sampaoli is a bit of a strange manager. I like him. I think he's good, but he also flatters to deceive sometimes, making some really weird decisions tactically. And he had a good spell with them 5 years ago or so, was it? Before he was hired by Argentina. So I can see the appeal of bringing him back, but with the situation they're in after, you know, Lopetegui's not great start to the season, I feel like you could have used someone, you know, with a calmer head. And Sampaoli attracts drama, and he's a hothead, basically, and he likes to get himself into trouble. So bringing him in, not bringing in the transfers that he wanted, you kind of just throw more fuel on the fire. And I kind of expect it to go to the, I don't think they're going to get relegated, but I think it'll get close. I don't think they're going to, they're going to pull away anytime soon. They're very average.
I mean, like two wins in the last three since coming back from the winter break. I mean, they did occupy a place in the bottom three for seemingly quite some time before the World Cup. But then, you know, they're not exactly being inspiring performances to drag themselves out of the bottom three. And it's not going to take much, you know, for the wheels to fall off there.
I mean, the penalty last night in the Cadiz game was ropey at best.
Yeah.
Like, I think it was, I can't work out if the guy's hand was kicked onto the ball or he slapped it away or what, but he looked a bit surprised by what was happening. So I think they were very lucky to win that one last night. I think is a good example.
Mm. Yeah, no, they were 100%. They were 100%. They were very lucky.
Yeah, completely. I mean, what do you see for the rest of the season for them, James? Do you see more of the same? and the struggles, or you know, is there a way to to more consistency and better performances as well?
Yeah, no, I think, to be honest with you, Steve, I think I agree with Matthew. I don't think they'll go down, but I think it's certainly, they're at a very critical crossroads, I would say, in terms of, because there was a weird interview that Monchi gave, I think it was back in sort of April, kind of towards the end of last season, where he was saying that they basically, Sevilla needed to change as a club, and there was this almost new approach to sort of signing players and whatnot, like Matthew sort of said about kind of this win now, signing proven players that would be able to come in and do a job. And I think I find it weird from an outside perspective that Sevilla have felt the need to change, because like you say, they've been so successful. Obviously you look at the success in the Europa League, especially the way that they've worked as a club. And I do think, I do think it's just overall just a strange situation. I think, going back to what you said, Steve, I don't think they'll go down, no, but I think it's very much a case where you look at Sevilla, I kind of group them in there with sort of like, you know, the likes of Benfica, Porto, Sporting, Ajax, you know, these teams that have always had this almost conveyor belt of they get a player in for a cheap price, they develop them, they sell them on, and that's kind of what keeps them going as a club. And I feel like you look at the team they've got now, and other than really one or two, you know, you've got Nianzu who's coming from Bayern, and you know, he's in 20, but he's looked a little bit shaky in some of the games I've seen. You know, you think of them losing Koundé and Carlos in the summer, they've not really replaced them. I mean, they signed Markel from Galatasaray, who, when he was at Galatasaray, was brilliant, but he came into Sevilla and he was injured when he got there. And then they've gone and signed Loic Bardet, who obviously, first half of the season, been on loan at Forest and not really played. And I do feel like it's just, there's not really much there that they can sell that's really got any resale value. And I think that overall, I think long term, you know, if next season, say, Sevilla are still struggling and the struggles continue, and you look at these clubs that have gone into this almost, you say about Atletico kind of like 25 years ago, with the sort of the, being the watchword for just being unstable, and almost, I think with them, it was almost like they had several years of decline until they actually went down. And I think unless Sevilla do maybe go back to what's worked for them in the past, you could almost see them, you say about kind of these English teams and, you know, the comparisons, I think maybe almost like, not quite exactly the same, but similar to sort of, you look at Southampton, the way in which 10 years ago, they had a strategy of more so academy prospects, but developing players and selling them and whatnot. And now they're not really, the identity of signings is almost gone. I feel like unless Sevilla rectify that, I think, yeah, they could be in for a challenging sort of couple of years to go.
Oh, completely. I mean, I think kind of like stripping back to basics, and I football, you know, it's a case of simplifying it. Sometimes, you know, a club will roll the dice, and that seems to be what Sevilla have done to try and bridge that gap, or to I don't know, but emulate what Atletico have done. You know, they've managed to take two La Liga titles in the last decade. You know, and Sevilla have looked at Atletico and thought we want a little bit of that as well. You know, so it's gambling the stability of a wider picture for the potential of a shot at the moon, basically, isn't it? But Matthew, you want to take a bit of a wider look at the state of play in La Liga. You know, what's piquing your interest in the minute of, amongst the other 19 teams of La Liga?
Well, there was a very interesting game today, this afternoon, between Elche and Osasuna, who are, I would say, are two similar sides in size and in stature, but having radically different seasons. Starting from the bottom up, Elche are absolutely rock bottom of the league. Before kickoff today, they had the same amount of points as managers they've had this season, which is 5. They've appointed 5 managers because things have been going so horribly. With a fun little fact that one of these managers is a former Eurovision Song Contest entrant, which, you know, a bit of fun. Only one other team in the history of the Spanish top flight has been able to rescue themselves from this position, which is Real Zaragoza in 2012. It's a bit surprising in that on paper they have a sort of lower mid-table squad, and that's kind of what people expected from them this season, just a, like a very uneventful season. And there's a few recognisable players like Federico Fernandez, signed from Newcastle, Domingos Quina, signed from Watford on loan. They've got Alex Collado, who's a really talented kid from Barcelona. And there's a striker in Luca Boye, who is really physical. I think he's a good striker. He's very physical, seems to score all their goals if they do get any. If they'd have started this season with Pablo Machin, who is their manager now, the story might have been different, but they've got 5 draws. They're looking hopeless. They're even already setting records. Their left back in the squad, Carlos Clerc, hasn't won a game in 38 games because he was part of the Levante squad last season that also got relegated. And it's pretty hopeless. They were up against Osasuna, who are just doing everything right at the minute. They are quite an incredible story, really, in that they sort of renovated their stadium, El Sadar, and it's become one of the most intimidating atmospheres in Spain. You can hear the atmosphere through your TV. They are not particularly lethal. They've only got 18 goals in 18 games, but defensively they've only conceded 17 as well. They've, despite letting a bunch of really important players go last season, they've got a really balanced squad with some good youth in Abde, John Moncayala, who does the Casemiro role really well. And then their sort of revelation of the season, who is Aymar Araujo, who I think is turning a lot of heads and he's going to have a lot of transfer interest soon. And then they've got a star man, Chimi Avila, who I really hate that I like this guy because his politics are kind of dodgy, but he's an absolute bull on the pitch. Like, every goal he scores is stunning. He scored an outstanding header today. And if you haven't seen it, he scored a goal of the season contender a few years ago with this sort of flicked the ball over his head and volleyed it in from about 25 yards against Huesca. It was a stunning goal. He would be playing for Barcelona now if he hadn't suffered successive ACL injuries. But the move never went through to Osasuna's benefit. And there's something happening in the north of Spain where all of the northern Spanish clubs at the minute are generating amazing players. Like, I mean, it's no surprise that Athletic Club, but Osasuna and Real Sociedad, 75% of their team at the minute are all kids that have come through the youth system. And it's the same with Osasuna, who are doing like amazingly well. Today, Elche woke up in the second half and went very close to winning their first game of the season, but just registered another draw. And they are currently on course to set a new lowest points total in the top division, which is currently 13 points. And honestly, you can't really see them getting out of it. They're pretty hopeless. Osasuna are one of this sort of chasing pack who are, you know, in the hunt for Europe, and it's really possible they can get it.
Oh, I mean, I've Osasuna's turnaround in particular has been a magnificent thing. It only seems a couple of years ago that they were struggling down the Segunda. I think they were scraping into eighth place or so for a place in the playoffs, and you know, for a team that. Have often been in that mid-ranging area of La Liga, you know, such a regular face. I mean, I remember going back to the 80s when Sammy Lee and Michael Robinson were playing for them, and you know, they were a club of purpose. They had a habit of turning teams over, you know, the biggest teams over, you know, occasionally shooting for a place in Europe. You know, they had that wonderful kind of, they're almost like a Spanish Coventry City of the time, really, who could kind of like, you know, be up there kind of like looking for a place in the top six, or, you know, just as easily as kind of like, you know, escaping relegation on the final day. You know, which, you know, as a supporter of them, you know, I often look at clubs like that and think, yeah, you know, when you support a football, it sounds awful, but sounds a football club that has that kind of, I don't know, same kind of season inside out, you know, for a Barcelona fan or a Real Madrid fan, for instance, that success becomes, you know, second nature. It becomes almost a guarantee. You know, you become accustomed to it. But you know, you look at a supporter of a club like an Osasuna, you know, that complex nature of just what version of your football club you're going to get. James, you know, your take on what's happening in Pamplona and that little bit further up in San Sebastian and across the Basque Country, a fascinating part of the footballing world.
Yeah, I mean, a fascinating part of the world in general, to be honest with you. I've only ever been to Bilbao out of all of that area, but I definitely recommend going there. I know this isn't sort of a travel podcast, but yeah, very, very nice place. But no, I think in terms of the football of it, yeah, I think we kind of touched upon it, but I think the thing with Osasuna that I find really interesting is, first and foremost, the manager, Arrasate, who's been there, you know, you say about them coming up through the playoffs. I think he's been there now about 5 or 6 years. So I think that's interesting that in this modern age, you don't necessarily tend to see a manager, you know, bring a, you know, they might bring a club up and then go to a bigger club, or they might come up and then it's almost like they feel like they've gone as far as they can. But I think it's almost just like, how far can Osasuna go, if you know what I mean? And I think the other thing as well is it's so interesting how I think there's only like 3 players in the entire squad that aren't Spanish, which I think is just, especially in this kind of modern age, is just fascinating. And I think they're always a club that I've had a little bit of an affinity to. Similarly, I think I remember, I think, was it 2005 or 2006 at the time when they finished 4th in La Liga. And that was when I was first really sort of started following La Liga, and it was on Sky every sort of Saturday and whatnot. They were always just a team that had this quite sort of, I don't know how to describe it really, but there was just always something about them that they kind of, they would sort of bounce around between various league positions. I think when they finished 4th the next season, they finished sort of mid-table, and it was almost like, that. Yeah, they're just a team I've always had a lot of affinity for. And I think, yeah, like we've said, they're definitely something that's, it's very interesting to see. I think a word on Elche. Every time I have watched Elche this season, it's the sort of thing of, I have a habit of, I don't like watching football games where I feel like one team is just going to lose. And I've kind of, I've broken that rule to watch Elche a couple of times a season, because I have looked and thought, they cannot be truly this bad. But yeah, it doesn't look good at all. And I think, Matthew said about the lowest point total thing, I think that we could be looking at sort of Spain's equivalent of Derby, and our famous team. I think they really are just they're not very good. And then, yeah, with regards to Real Sociedad, just quickly, yeah, I mean, I think they're third at the moment. Obviously, they beat United in the Europa League, didn't they? I think, yeah, they're looking very, very good. And I think they're a team, again, that I've always had a lot of affinity. Sociedad and Celta Vigo, and then also Deportivo, all of those kind of northern teams right along the coast. I don't know what it is about them. I don't know if it's the fact they all have quite a nice kit, but I think they're three teams that I've always had an affinity for. And I mean,
well, I think Spanish football always looks that bit more resplendent when Real Sociedad are doing so well. You know, again, being a child of the 80s, you know, I remember them being the Liga winners 81 and 82. And then obviously towards the end of the 80s, breaking that non-Basque rule and bringing in John Aldridge, swiftly followed by Damian Atkinson and Kevin Richardson and, you know, all of that. You know, John Toshak, being associated with them as well. You know, they just had a kind of air to them and that, I don't know, that part of the world as well. And the fact that they kind of upset the apple cart a bit at Athletic Club as well. You know, a club that I have massive respect for as well. But I think the great thing about, you know, Sociedad is the success that they had last season. They built upon it. You know, they're currently in third place, but not, you know, by being at the forefront of something of a demolition derby. They've kind of like put a cushion between themselves and what's behind them. I mean, looking at that table tonight, I mean, it's 6 points separate Atleti in fourth and Real Mallorca in 10th. You know, there is a defined kind of wacky races type of thing going on that could unfold for that final Champions League place. But, you know, as long as Sociedad stay the course and keep this consistency up, then they should be comfortably in third place behind whoever out of Barcelona or Real Madrid picks off the Liga title this season. Matthew, I mean, any kind of, for that fourth place, I mean, we were talking last weekend about Diego Simeone and you know, there's rumblings that, you know, it could be the beginning of the end for him. You know, he's possibly taking them as far as he can. You know, do we think Atleti will manage to kind of like break away and, you know, take that fourth place, or do you see someone from that little middle chasing pack to challenge them for Champions League football?
When you said breakaway, I thought maybe in the opposite direction, because things are just very stale at Atleti at the minute. And I think there are a lot of rumours, aren't there, that this is Simeone's final season. And I think it's time. I think it's a bit like Arsene Wenger in that, like, he's been there for 15 years. He's built them in his image. Without Simeone, they wouldn't have these titles of the last 10 years. Exactly. They wouldn't they wouldn't be a Champions League squad. They'd be stuck in mid-table somewhere. So,
no, most definitely. Does this make kind of like Real Sociedad the new Atleti, at least in the short term?
I mean, it's a good example of what James mentioned earlier about, you know, having faith and sticking with the manager, because what's his face? Imanol Alguacil has been in charge for 6 years now, and sort of, I mean, the man bleeds blue and white. Like he went through the youth system. He made over 100 appearances for them as a defender. When he retired from the game, he rejoined them as a youth coach in 2011, meaning that he's been there since another 12 years. I mean, he's a really likable manager, and just since he's come in, there's just been an upward trajectory for them. I don't know if you guys saw, but after the Copa del Rey win last season, he, in the post-match conference after the final, he took off his like shirt to reveal like a Real Sociedad shirt underneath and held up a scarf and started singing like a Sociedad war song or something. He's a fan, like he adores the club. I don't know what he'll do if he ever leaves, because I mean, I can't imagine Alguacil without La Real, and I can't imagine it either way around. And there's like another really heartwarming video of, because obviously this was their first major trophy for about 20 years or something, the fans going up to his apartment in the city, in San Sebastian, sorry, and sort of singing to him outside of his balcony, and him coming out and joining in as well. If they carry on, and they're a very smart club, with, you know, great youth recruitment. I think something like 70% of their appearances this season have been from club-trained players, homegrown players. So, I mean, it's pretty special what they're doing. And if they carry on with it, I don't see why not. Little mentions as well for like Villarreal and Real Betis, who are both very sensible clubs. I think Quique Setién had a bit of a ropey start at Villarreal, but he's sort of turning it around, and They got a very ropey win today with two penalties in the last 8 minutes of added on time, and missed one, scored the other, which was a bit lucky, but I think he's all right. He's a good manager and he's doing decent things with them. And I mean, Real Betis are one of the model clubs of Europe, really. They do everything right, and Pellegrini's got to, you know, do really, really well with them. And I just got to end on a biased little shout out for my Spanish team, Rayo Vallecano, who I lived in the area for a few years and sort of adopted them as my second team. And they play kind of, I don't know if it's like Jurgen Klopp inspired heavy metal football, but it's, you know, really heavy on the fullbacks, 100% every game. It's another Northern manager doing wonderful things with a really small club who are, there's always trouble off the pitch with the president, but he's the manager in Iraola is doing amazing things, you know, making a team that is better than the sum of its parts. And I think that if they carry on, they can get Europe, but it's a bit of a, there's four or five teams in there that can really sort of, if they string a few results together, it could go to anyone. So I don't think you can call it. I don't think you can predict it.
No, it does make it for a fascinating league, and the second half of the season that's just about to unfold should be magnificent. And the Copa del Rey, you know, we'll a quick mention for that as well. You know, the quarterfinals are coming up. Barcelona, Sociedad, Osasuna, Sevilla, Valencia, Athletic Club, Real Madrid, Atleti. You know, that's a really kind of attractive set of ties there. Osasuna, surely, and with a really good chance, having just spoken about those, you know, against the Sevilla, that would have to really kind of, you know, turn their season on its head to overcome that one. Yeah, you know, you're looking at the rank and file of Barcelona, Atleti, you know, Real Madrid being there, but, you know, do we see a left field winner, but someone from the added extras coming through to win this again this season, or will it be a case of the monopoly striking again, Matthew?
I can see a left field one. I think the Copa del Rey has been quite unpredictable over the last few years with the two. Is it Valencia won a few years ago? Real Sociedad won one last year. I can see it being, you know, a left field choice, either in like Osasuna basically. I quite fancy to get into the semis anyway.
It would be marvelous, James. You know, are you gonna put throw a name out there for the Copa del Rey?
I think it's difficult to really judge, isn't it, because it's the sort of thing where if you were making, and obviously we don't want to do this and promote this, but if you were making a sort of a super league of Spanish teams at the moment in terms of the best team in Spain, you know, that there is basically the eight best teams really at the moment. you know, barring, obviously, we spoke about Sevilla. So I think, yeah, I mean, look, let's just say Osasuna, because it would be the sort of thing where I don't want to copy Matthew, but it's the sort of thing where I'm a romantic and I love teams, you know, getting those days out and getting those fantastic moments. And it's the sort of thing where, given the way they're playing, barring maybe today, because the Elche, as we spoke about, I think they're definitely in with a chance, yeah. So
it would be the feel-good story, wouldn't it, if Osasuna could pull it off. I mean, it's got, like, the Pokal, you know, in Germany, and Eintracht Frankfurt winning it, and what they've managed to go on to do, you know, after that as well, in winning the Europa League. You know, I think some of the domestic cups have, I don't know, kind of like saving the day almost from these hegemonies of league titles being won, and the same old faces, certainly in the Champions League anyway. Talking of Germany, the Bundesliga, you know, kicked back into action this weekend. Bayern Munich held to a draw by RB Leipzig, or vice versa, if you want to see it that way. You know, they held a 5-point lead, but are missing some, you know, important names at the minute. You know, they should walk it, but there's been some interesting results and interesting performances from a collection of the teams. Eintracht Frankfurt continue to impress. RB Leipzig, like, love them or loathe them, are continuing to hover on the periphery. Freiburg, you know, have had that wonderful first half of the season. Everyone loves to see Union Berlin up there. You know, if it wasn't for Bayern Munich and this horrendous run of success that they've had, you know, German football would be, I think, on many, many people's agendas this time as well. I mean, there's the midweek round of games as well. I mean, I find it interesting. This midweek will kind of, I don't know, it will either be sink or swim for a title race in Germany. A midweek round of games, then the weekend. Bayern Munich have two home games, Cologne in midweek, then Frankfurt. But, you know, Cologne have just put seven past, I can't remember who it was now off the top of my head. But then, you know, Frankfurt, who have been playing so well, you know, if Bayern drop points at home in the next two games, have we got a potential for a title race? And Freiburg face Frankfurt themselves, then Augsburg, but both at home. Leipzig have Schalke on the road, you know, the epically doomed Schalke, followed by, you know, Stuttgart at home, who, again, are labouring themselves. Union Berlin have road trips to Bremen, but also Hertha in the Berlin derby at the weekend. You know, I think there's some fascinating stuff in Germany if you take away the prospect of Bayern Munich absolutely running away. That, again, James, you know, are we ever going to be in hope of seeing a team other than Bayern Munich win the Bundesliga anytime soon?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, I mean, we're only a quarter of the way through this century, so I think at some point before the end of it, we're probably going to have
the Lord of Averages
champion that isn't Bayern. But yeah, it does sort of feel that way. That, and it's really frustrating as well, because I think it's the sort of thing of people from a very sort of surface level can look at the Bundesliga and obviously the fact that Bayern have dominated the past decade and say, well, that's boring. But it's the sort of thing of, if you... It might sound an odd approach to take, but I think if you take away who actually wins the league, the rest, it kind of, in a little bit, like, maybe not so much this season, but like with Ligue 1 and with obviously PSG's dominance for much of the past decade as well, the rest of the league is actually really, really interesting. I think this season especially, I mean, obviously Freiburg's result yesterday, we'll kind of sweep that under the carpet a bit, but Freiburg have obviously, and that's not just a flash in the pan. You look at the way that they've kind of really developed as a club, obviously with the new stadium they've built and the players they've got coming through there, obviously Schlotterbeck that they sold in the summer to Dortmund, and they're almost getting into this, because I feel like we are now in this very much this model of big, the top level clubs, they'll just pay 50, 60 million pounds for whoever, and then the clubs below will have to, you know, develop players and sell them on to be able to compete, sort of thing. You know, you look, obviously, the model that Brighton have as one example in England. But I think, yeah, certainly Freiburg and obviously Frankfurt, you know, winning the Europa League, Union Berlin have just gone from strength to strength over the last 5 years. I think it's a fascinating league, especially this season. I mean, if, obviously, it's being very presumptuous, you know, Dortmund today, it was very back and forth against Augsburg in a 4-3. So there's no guarantee that they're, you know, they're going to have to get the skates on if they're going to get in the Champions League, I would say, because they haven't looked overly convincing. You know, if we're going to end with a top four as it is now, if you had a top four where you've got Freiburg potentially in the Champions League, you've got Union Berlin in the Champions League, I think from my perspective, that's brilliant. You know, these are clubs that do not traditionally have success. Obviously, Union have very much lived in the shadow of Hertha for pretty much all their existence. You know, and Freiburg were always one of those kind of elevator clubs, as they call them in Germany, that was never really too solid in the Bundesliga. It was always kind of up and down. And for them, obviously, being in the Pokal final last year was a big step. Obviously, couldn't quite go the same way that Frankfurt did with actually winning it. But I think, yeah, as I say, it's a fascinating league, and it's just a shame that, as much as we can say, it's a big if, you know, for a title race. I think I can't see anything personally other than Bayern winning it again. But you know, I've been proven wrong in the past, so hopefully this is one of those occasions.
I think yeah, I mean you're right. I mean, but I always say, well, points can often fudge a wider picture when it comes to league tables, but goal difference never tells a lie. And you know, Bayern are up there on a plus 30 odd already, when you know a good 20 odd goals ahead of everyone else. I think if they contrive to lose the title from here, then you know it's an epic mishap. You know, but as sad as it is, but I mean at the opposite end of the spectrum, Schalke struggling massively again, Matthew. Stuttgart down there. You know, these teams that, I mean, James has just illuminated just how well the likes of Freiburg are playing. It's brilliant to see Union up there. So these teams that have kind of like come from left field and you know, built something very, very stable and very, very special. And then you have the volatility, these big clubs that have been over the years, the prime contenders to knock Bayern off periodically, the top of the table, you know, struggling so badly. You know, even when you know, Schalke only came back last season after their relegation. You know, Werder Bremen, another one. You know, you only have to look at HSV's struggles in trying to return to the Bundesliga after their relegation a few years ago. Even when you look at, say, Kaiserslautern, who were, you know, double Bundesliga title winners in the early to mid-1990s. You know, they went down to, you know, the Three Liga. They came back up last season. Many tipped them for relegation back down to the third tier this season, but they're up there towards the top end of Bundesliga 2. You know, there is still a lot going for German football, you know, away from this, I don't know, reign of terror of Bayern Munich.
James nailed it. It's exactly the same thing I do with France, because I am a fan of French football, and you just ignore PSG. And then the league just becomes a lot more interesting, because it's always like, it's never the same teams competing these days because of the volatility of the league and the clubs. And same in Germany, really, where it's like a whirling maelstrom of teams of who are the contenders this year. In terms of like the relegation picture, looking at the Bundesliga, in the nicest way possible, I've been laughing at Hertha Berlin for a lot of years now. They are kind of the German Everton, in that they are incredibly rich. They have so much money and they just don't know what to do with it. They just keep throwing money at players, at managers, and nothing ever comes off. And every year I don't know how they haven't been relegated yet, really. I think last year should have been the year, and they got out of it at the last second, I think. It's kind of amazing, really, that the capital club is mired in that sort of issues season after season. Same for Schalke, who, correct me if I'm wrong, Schalke are the second most supported team in Germany.
Huge, technically, Schalke, absolutely huge. I mean, they've never managed to win the title during the Bundesliga era, but you know, I think the last title was it 59 or 60 or something like that, just in the latter stages of the old regional Liga era. But yeah, an absolutely, you know, massive, massive football club, you know, as far as German football is concerned.
Just colossal underachievement, really, then, isn't it, by them? Like, just, you just expect more from them every season, and it's just mismanagement. I know there was a lot of issues with the chairman, who, you know, provides half of the funding in the 50 plus one model. So I want to say there was some COVID related stuff, which is why they lost a lot of money. And I think he came out with some pretty dodgy comments, which doesn't, you know, doesn't help that kind of thing. It's kind of, it is sad to see them down there, and, you know, it's mismanagement. Yeah. And just to mention, I find the Union Berlin story very heartwarming. I think, you know, coming from, was it, 5 years ago when the stadium's by hand, you know, rebuilt the stadium. And it's one of those stories in football that, you know, shows you there's another way and gives you a little bit of hope that we're not going to be seeing these, you know, billionaire funded clubs dominating world football forever. You kind of, it gives you a little bit of hope that, you know, there's, like I said, there's another way.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, back to, you know, fortunes on the pitch, you know, Bayer Leverkusen have turned a big corner since Xavi Alonso took over. You know, and they're on the back of about four successive victories. You know, there's a bit of a points gap to bridge if they're going to challenge for Champions League football. But, you know, Xavi Alonso, you know, the manager, I can always remember having conversations with fellow Liverpool supporters about, you know, Steven Gerrard when he was, you know, just breaking three of Anfield and he'd taken over at Rangers and so on and so forth. And people chatted about him as a future Liverpool manager. And I can remember saying at the time, you know, if I could pick a Liverpool midfielder of the past to be, you know, a future successor to Jurgen Klopp, then I'd go down the line of Xavi Alonso before I'd go down the line of Steven Gerrard. And being kind of lambasted for it, you know, I'm not saying Steven Gerrard's finished by a manager by any means. You know, he'll have another go somewhere else. And, you know, Alonso will have his bumpy periods as well, but it's going exceptionally well for him at the minute, isn't it?
It's a nice little link back to what we were talking about before and Real Sociedad, because he, you know, came through the youth, the coach in the youth teams there. So he's done, you know, they have their way of doing things in San Sebastian, and it's translating well to Germany. So, you know, more power to him.
And James, you know, as far as German football is concerned, you know, who do you see as being, you know, those, who's going to take those Champions League places? Who's going to be the big giant that drops down into the two Bundesliga?
I think it looks pretty bad for Schalke, doesn't it? I think Schalke. I think at this stage, though, it's almost as if, I don't know, it's one of those weird ones where it's not as surprising, because obviously when they went down the first time, even though it had been coming for two or three seasons, it was the sort of thing where no one was really too surprised. And I think now it's almost the thing where, obviously, you mentioned about Stuttgart. Obviously, Werder were down there after several years of really not doing very much in the Bundesliga. Obviously, Hamburg, which as a just a quick caveat, I do find amusing how since they've been relegated, I mean, this is the fifth season they've been in the second division, and they've never finished below fourth, which is extremely consistent, but it's just unfortunately not quite there. I mean, I think if German football was designed slightly differently and had a playoff system that was more conventional, as we see in the Championship and in sort of Spain as well, then maybe they probably would have got lucky in one of those. But I think, as I said, I think Schalke, it looks pretty hopeless.
It does look pretty great.
I don't have too much hope for Stuttgart either, which is a real shame because I really do like Stuttgart as a club. And then I think Champions League-wise, I think Dortmund will sneak in there, just purely because you look at the quality of the squad. I think Frankfurt will get in there, and I'm going to say I think Freiburg will stay there. I think whilst Xabi Alonso, obviously, say he's doing very well at Leverkusen, obviously they beat Mönchengladbach today. Yeah, I just like to be a bit different. I think Freiburg, when you watch Freiburg play, they're a very, very good watch. They're very, very well run, as I say. They're moving in the right direction with the new stadium. And I think, it'd be a very just reward, I think, if they could sneak in one of those Champions League places.
Hey, Matthew, added to that, Wolfsburg are on a fantastic run of results, and that 6-0 win against Freiburg yesterday, you know, goes a long way into kind of like, you know, boosting their confidence. Not being spoken about much in when it comes to talking about German, you know, the Bundesliga. You know, they are the form team, though, arguably.
You would come to me with Wolfsburg when I know nothing about them. I do know, however, that they have Jonas Vind, the Danish kid, who is very highly rated. And I want to say he scored two or three goals yesterday against Freiburg.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I think he's going to be one of these talents that he's going to be picked up by a Premier League club at some point, because he's been, you know, touted from an early age, and now he seems to be delivering for Wolfsburg, which is, I mean, like you say, form team. They've won five in a row now, something like that.
I think with Wolfsburg, I mean, they had that Bundesliga title success of what must be coming up to about 15 years ago, and they've never kind of pushed on from that. They've been a watchword for inconsistency, you know, across the last decade to decade and a half now. And I find them an interesting concept now, is that suddenly they're just finding some kind of, I don't know, just some kind of run that's going to put them in an interesting place if they can continue that consistency.
I think will sneak into the Champions League, I think it might be Union Berlin. I think they are, it's a bit similar to Freiburg, really. I mean, you're splitting hairs here because they're both fantastic stories. But I think the transfer business and the transfer dealings Union do is so smart and so, like, so shrewd, just to, you know, to sell Awani to Forest last summer and then to replace him with Becker. And he's just hit the ground running and just goals him up front with, you know, just replacing Awani, and they haven't skipped a beat and they just carried on. Then they were bogged down a little bit in towards before the Christmas break. There was too many games, not enough rest for the players, but now they can be getting back to like a bit more of a normal schedule. I think they might just sneak into maybe, you know, like fourth place by the end of the season. It might be a straight shootout between them and Freiburg, though.
Fantastic. I'm sure we will revisit you know, these fantastic kitchen sink dramas in Spain and Germany and way beyond as well, as the season progresses. I mean, looking forward ahead of ourselves, Matthew, you wanted to raise the topic or the, you know, the controversy surrounding John Yems.
Yeah, I'm being a bit cheeky by slotting this in the looking forward bit, because this has actually happened already. But just to recap, former Crawley manager John Yems was banned from football for 18 months this week by the FA, after an independent panel found that he was, and I'm going to quote, not a conscious racist, which, coming after reports of 16 separate charges of him using racist and derogatory language towards Black and Asian players, is something. I'm not going to read it out, but I think anyone who hasn't seen this yet should go read the reports. It's pretty horrific stuff, but I think important to get like a full picture of it. Kick It Out released a statement, said that they condemn this verdict, describing it as a slap in the face to victims of discriminatory abuse detailed in the report, and anyone who has been subject to racism or Islamophobia. And it's totally right. I mean, aside from the fact that The Guardian have already found that the independent panel, and it's important to point that it's an independent panel, not the FA themselves, but The Guardian found that they stepped the mark and they went over what that commission was supposed to be in publishing this, you know, the reasons for why they said, or the reasons for the ban. And regardless of whether it was deliberate or not, conscious or unconscious, actions speak louder than words. And he did it. It wasn't a one-time slip. He abused players repeatedly. One player was so affected by the comments, by Yems' comments, that he pretended to be sick to avoid going into work. And no one forced Yems to make these comments. Internal complaints were made and he still carried on with these comments. And I refuse to believe, you know, when you look at some of the terms and behaviour he exhibited, that he didn't know what he was doing and that he knew it wasn't funny or banter or not acts of racism. And I think this is a sort of perfect example of this in football, in that racist attitude and racist behaviour is racism regardless of intent. And it is a really dangerous precedent of this independent panel to be stating whether that is conscious or unconscious. It's the game and society deserves better, in my opinion.
Oh, completely. I mean, James, you know, I think Matthew's eloquently and just brilliantly, bluntly put it the way it is there. But, you know, this as cultures go, you know, it's an abhorrent situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the whole wording of it. It's just so strange, you know, what is an unconscious racist? I mean, I saw someone, it's obviously not something to make light of, but I saw someone on Twitter kind of replying to a question of that with a photo of William Gallas kicking John Terry in the head, but that's the sort of thing of like, I don't really understand how can you unconsciously be racist? It just doesn't make any sense. And I think, like Matthew says, it does set a very dangerous precedent going forwards. I mean, just as a side note, Crawley as a club are just a complete and utter shambles. They're just a complete mess of a club from top to bottom, but you know, we won't go into that now. But I do just think going forwards, it's the sort of thing where it is all very well and good for the FA to have, you know, obviously we saw with the World Cup, with obviously the whole armband situation and then kind of relenting on that. And I understand that, you know, maybe there it was a bit more of a touchy subject if it involves, you know, England maybe being docked points or something. But I do just think it's the sort of thing where, you know, as Matthew said, actions do speak louder than words. And I think it's the sort of thing where it's all very well and good to have these campaigns, but if you're not marrying it up with taking decisive action to stop this, you know, who's to say that there isn't, I mean, there definitely is another John Yams out there. Unfortunately, it's not going to be the last time we see this, and the FA are going to have to look into something like this. And I think if they did take a harsher stance here, rather than, you know, kind of almost sort of tiptoeing around the issue fully, we would see a more sort of swift resolution to this kind of, as you say, abhorrent behaviour.
I mean, it is like ludicrous to think it's 2023 and this is still, you know, tripping up in such a, I don't know, such a ludicrous manner. You know, we've seen it in the last year with Yorkshire Cricket Club, and it's that, I don't know, it's just a culture of, you know, that I mean, within that, you know, the dressing rooms like that, when that goes on, then for a manager, a coach, directors, whatever it is, for it to continue speaks that there is at least a partial audience for it within those environments, which is the indicative thing here. And then it's where it spreads from there that they take it forward themselves into their own spheres, wherever they go on from the different changing rooms as a player or into their own coaching careers. We talk about a man that's in his early 60s who was going to be, what, in his you know, 40 at the turn of the millennium. We're not talking of someone who's, you know, in their 80s or the 90s that you know, will often turn around and say it was a different world. But even then, you know, I have, you know, my dad's in his mid 80s. He's not racist. You know, he'll be, you know, I can remember as a kid him using racist terminology, but, you know, as a man who over recent, not recent years, but recent decades, you know, he learned that this was unacceptable. You know, I can remember going to a Liverpool game, 87 it would have been, not long after John Barnes signed. And, you know, we'd only had Howard Gale as a black player. And, you know, I can remember the racism that was written on walls, the graffiti and stuff like that, Liverpool are white and also all of that. And I can remember being sat in the Kemlin Road, which is now the Kenneth Dalglish stand, was the centenary. And two fellas in flat caps sat in front of me. And it must have been Barnes' first appearance at Anfield in a Liverpool shirt. And, you know, took the ball, you know, wonderful piece of control, turned his marker, he was off and away. And the two fellas in front of me, who must have been in the 70s at the time, turned round, one turned to the other and said, oh, maybe he's not as black as we thought he was. And it was that kind of, you know, stunning kind of line that was of its generation, but it was also kind of like telling that it was almost kind of like it made them think, you know, as well, you know. So it's like education is absolutely everything in these circumstances, but the fear, it's because it is such a divided country as well, and that horrible, I don't know, is that horrible street within football supporters and that's got to go into football players as well and coaches, is that, I don't know, that need to shock, that need to, I don't know, upset sensibilities, what they see as sensibilities. It's the that dividing line between what, you know, one I don't know, partisan side of a dividing line will shout woke at one side and the others will shout gammon at the others. It is sadly going to be, as James said, you know, we'll never eradicate it. It'll always be a thing. There'll always be people who want to spin these lines and these ways of thinking, and sadly there will continue to be, you know, willing listeners to it. But yeah, moving on, you know, back to the pitch, and we'll try and wrap up on more romantic themes. The FA Cup fourth round is approaching next weekend, and James, there's a big match going on for the team close to your heart.
Yeah, well, it was the sort of thing of when you asked me about something I was looking forward to, I thought I can't be that predictable and choose Wrexham, but then I thought,
no, you can be as predictable as you want to.
because yeah, it's the sort of thing where we're through to the fourth round of the FA Cup for the first time, I think, since like 1990s, 2000s or time. And we're playing Sheffield United at home. I'm saying we're as if everyone presumptively knows I'm a Wrexham fan, but for those who don't, I am a Wrexham fan. And yeah, it's promises to be a very interesting game, really, because it's the sort of thing where obviously Sheffield United are in incredible form. You know, I think they've lost in the league like one game, bizarrely with all teams, was to Rotherham, but they've lost one game, I think, in like 3 or 4 months. The form they're in is remarkable. Won again on Friday against Hull. And it's going to be interesting because they're, as I say, very good form. We are also in very good form. I think we're unbeaten since the beginning of October in the league. In all competitions, actually, in fact, if you discount losing on penalties last week to Altrincham in the FA Trophy. So it's the sort of thing where it is really two teams in incredible form. And obviously the slightly different levels of the footballing pyramid, but it's going to be interesting with a sold out race course and, you know, the BBC cameras there to see how it goes. It's the sort of thing where, unfortunately, I've supported Wrexham for too long to be anything other than pessimistic, even with the form that we're in and the new money and obviously all the attention around the club. I'm still extremely worried and think we're going to get rolled over. But just that aside, I think it's just going to be a fantastic occasion. And in the previous round, we beat Coventry 4-3 away at Coventry's ground. And it's just so nice to have the FA Cup, really, because it's such a big part of Wrexham's story, obviously, with the Arsenal game in 92, and then just other games against sort of West Ham and teams like that, Middlesbrough as well. It's really part of the fabric of the club. So it promises to be an incredibly exciting game. And as I say, whilst I'm pessimistic, I am still looking forward to it. So yeah, that's why I've gone for it.
Oh, it is going to be a huge occasion. You know, a soft spot for Wrexham that goes back a long, long time. You know, I've cited them before as being part of the what I call the Liverpool Echo footprints. Is the Liverpool Evening newspaper. You know, you get kind of like all the Liverpool content, all the Everton content, the Tranmere, and then by the time you got to kind of like the fourth or the fifth page in, it was all about Wrexham, it was all about Chester, Southport, it was all of those teams that are just on the periphery of the area, basically. And obviously, you know, the Liverpool connections to like Joey Jones and all of that, you know, I remember Wrexham being a second division club. Those great years in Europe in the Cup Winners' Cup, all of that, you know, I can remember Wrexham taking on Everton and giving them a hell of a scare, and I think at 81 in the FA Cup. And I don't know, I've had great trips to the race course, you know, pre-season friendlies and stuff like that. Delighted to see what's going on with the club. And, you know, to go from, I don't know, the struggles of the last decade or so to being, I don't know, kind of like there they are in the fourth round of the FA Cup live on the BBC, which always feels a bit better, but, you know, always feels like you're the real deal when you're picked by the BBC as a part for, you know, rather than ITV, I think. You know, it makes it feel like you're kind of like, you know, you're under the limelight then. You're serious business. But yeah, you know how well they're playing, and I think it's going to be, you know, a massively interesting tie. I mean, Matthew, can Wrexham do it?
I think they definitely can do it. I think Sheffield United are good, but it's the FA Cup, isn't it? It's a cup competition when these sort of things can happen. And I think especially with, you know, the feel good factor that is with Wrexham at the minute with the takeover, which I'm really jealous of, I'm not going to lie. all of that can carry you a long way. And they've got Paul Mullin, who, you know, Paul Mullin scores goals. You got Bentoza throwing it with those absolute rockets of long throws, launching them in. They can do it. I don't see any reason why not.
There's no reason to be scared anyway, is there? There's no reason to go in with any fear. I think they're still in that position to be able to kind of like enjoy occasions like this as they move forward, but also not just go, I mean, not in a kind of a condescending kind of way. There's every chance of, you know, the every reason to compete, every reason to feel like they can win the game, but also not to fear it and to enjoy it. and just, you know, use it as a as part of this fantastic, I know, arc of growth, basically. I mean, other ties as well in the fourth round that really stand out to me, and obviously have Man City, Arsenal. I mean, it's boring, isn't it? You know, it's interesting in a side effect of the title race. You know, one's going to knock the other one out and all that type of stuff. What's the knock-on effect? You know, might do Arsenal a favour to go out, you know, to be able to say, well, look, you know, you not just, you know, got Europe still dotted around, but, you know, it's still a bit dull. Brighton against Liverpool, even though it's my team, God, that's still a bit dull. But, you know, the fixtures that are standing out to me, you know, Accrington are boring, but we'll take on Leeds, which is going to be, you know, really interesting. The massively dysfunctional Leicester City, winners of the FA Cup not all that long ago, travelling to Walsall, who have massively underachieved in recent years, dropped down to the fourth tier. They're in League Two. You know, they're only about 10th place. They're not far off the playoff places, but, you know, that has a magnificent ring to that tie. Ipswich Burnley is one that really stands out as well. Ipswich are going great in League Two, early League One. Burnley are flying in the Championship, absolutely flying. And Derby West Ham, you know, Derby trying to battle back, West Ham trying to find some kind of consistency after a difficult start to this season. Matthew, you know, if I was to give you kind of like a £5 each way bet, where are you placing it for your fourth round upset?
I'm looking at Walsall Leicester as well. I think Leicester are very ropey, very uninspired at the minute. Like there's not a lot of creativity coming from them. And I think Walsall are in half decent form. I think they've got something like 3 wins in 5. His name's Michael Flynn, right, the manager. He's doing a fairly decent job. I was a bit of surprised that he went there from Newport, and I think he's doing a half decent job. I was a bit surprised that one isn't on TV.
Yeah, me too.
Feels like there's giant killing potential there. I think there's potential in Preston Spurs. Preston are very good defensively, and Spurs struggle to break down teams who are quite good defensively. So, you know, with the funk they're in at the minute, I think Preston can give them a game, and I think that could, you know, that could go, maybe not extra time, but that could go, you know, pretty close. And I'm saying keep an eye on Blackburn versus my team, Birmingham, because I predict that might be the most boring FA Cup tie in history. Blackburn are very decent and they're quite fun to watch. I think they, I don't know what the final score was, but they either haven't drawn yet this season or got their first draw of the season yesterday. But we are stinking out the Championship once again. We had a good first half of the season, and then since Christmas it's been awful. But we could be taking up to 7,000 fans to Lancashire, which I think would be one of our biggest away followings for a long, long time. And they will make some noise and there will be some anti-ownership protests. So it could be an interesting one. I don't mean that actually it's going to be so boring I wouldn't watch them.
Another one I'd throw into the mix there is Blackpool's trip to Southampton. Blackpool turned over Nottingham Forest despite massively dysfunctional league form. They'll be facing a side that will surely be looking at the League Cup encounters to come as being the ones to really kind of focus on. Sounds daft to say that placing the FA Cup fifth round should be gambled at that expense. But, you know, half a chance for Blackpool at Southampton. You know, Southampton bizarre. You know, they felt hard done by yesterday by not taking something from Aston Villa. You know, they got that massive win at Goodison Park. They've made it to the semi-finals of the League Cup. They won the FA Cup tie as well. Nathan Jones, a lot of criticism up until a fortnight ago, even a week and a half ago, suddenly looks a little bit more rose. But Blackpool, you know, again, another one. I mean, James, where are you putting your £5 each way bet on? Away from the Wrexham, although you say you're pessimistic about Wrexham's chances, you know, where is your shot coming from in the fourth round?
I think there's two there that you've alluded to already. I think Walsall against Leicester is one that I could definitely see going the way of, you could say, the underdog, really, in Walsall. They definitely are the underdog. But it's weird, actually, for that. I've been keeping an eye on that one because I went to watch the first round. They played Wickham away and they beat them. I think it was 2-0. And I mean, Wickham were absolutely awful in that game. But Warsaw did actually look quite good, and they thoroughly deserve to win that. So I'll definitely be, if not watching it, obviously with it not being on TV, I'll definitely try and keep up to date with it. And then I think I'm looking at the Blackpool game. I think obviously, you know, like you say, they didn't just beat Forest in the previous round. They really did turn them over. And I think it's the sort of thing with Southampton where I think just more broadly, it's interesting that, I mean, I think is it half exactly? But there's definitely a lot of the Premier League teams that are not in the fourth round, which is a slightly strange one, you could say. But I think it's the sort of thing where if you look at a team sort of like Southampton or the other game as well, I think I could see Derby getting a result against West Ham. I think, you know, with that being sort of a Monday night game under the lights, I'm pretty certain it's at Pride Park, isn't it? With, you know, Paul Warner's got Derby doing very, very well. West Ham, I think the last thing they really could do with at the moment is a cup run the way they're playing. You know, it'd be interesting to see if, I think Moyes will probably make it to that. But, you know, if they lose that, it really could be the end for him. So, yeah, I'd probably say Blackpool, and then the Derby game would be the two ones I'd put my money on.
No, plenty to look forward to. One last one there as well. FA Cup replays, you know, ending at the fourth round. A good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, I think it's the sort of thing where we're, you know, you think of them, they're obviously got a lot of magic to them. I mean, from my perspective, weirdly, the result I actually kind of want on Sunday is I would actually quite like a draw against Sheffield United because I've never been to Bramall Lane.
Yeah.
So I would actually quite like to go there, and it was going to the Coventry for the previous round, probably the best atmosphere I've ever experienced watching Wrexham. It was fantastic. So something similar like that would be great. But I think especially at the moment with there is just so much football on, it's a little bit ridiculous, isn't it? I think as much as replays do have their kind of romance to them, you could also make the argument with the increase of games, they are a little bit archaic, yeah.
And sometimes, I mean, obviously, if this is a podcast I was doing with Gary and Paul, then the answer would be very different, that replays should ramble on for 3, 4, 5 games, and that's because they did in the past. And there were some magnificent ties and stuff like that, but it's 30 years now since multiple replays were stopped. You know, one replay and then it's straight into a penalty shootout. And, you know, part of me kind of like thinks that sometimes when you get a draw between two teams, especially if there's a defined gap in the league spectrum between the two, you know, that one chance is probably the best, you know, the best chance for a smaller team to go through. You look at Chesterfield, you know, being held to that draw, you know, so close to that victory against West Brom. Game goes to a replay and they're never really in the replay as such. You know, if that original game, you know, ebbs through to its penalty shootout, you know, maybe it's Chesterfield going through instead. You know, I don't think, you know, monetary gain aside, it doesn't always work out that, you know, a smaller team that's had one bite of the cherry, it's not like Lightning is going to strike twice by them winning the replay anyway.
Yeah, I think absolutely, yeah. I think just in terms of, I mean, even just the third round, just again to bring Wrexham up, that last 20 minutes was probably the longest 20 minutes of my life because, you know, Coventry hit the post, there was a chance that was cleared off the line, and it's the sort of thing there where I think if that would have gone to a replay, they come to the race course and they turn us over because we were very lucky. It's a strange one because for the majority of that game, we were very, very good and we deserved to win. But from sort of, you know, 65, 70 minutes, it was quite scary. And I think, say, the Chesterfield game, yeah, it's the sort of thing where it's in a cup competition. I guess in a way you could argue that's what makes it, you know, it's a one-off game and anything can happen. But I think when you put it, you know, you add in extra games, the better team and the better quality players do generally tend to kind of come to the fore. So, yeah, I think it's the sort of thing where, like you say, I think maybe it is an age divide. But, I think them being scrapped is for the better, really.
Yeah, I mean, it makes little sense to me to have them up to the fourth round and then stop them. It's either like I have them or don't have them, you know, across the board. And, you know, it's I don't think it can necessarily detract from a competition that's altered so much anyway already. You know, it's, probably time to move on. But yes, thank you so much for taking part in tonight's podcast, Matthew. excellent, excellent conversations, excellent topics. A joy to have you back on.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to come on and talk all things Spanish.
Excellent. And James, brilliant to have you on once again. And look forward to you being back on very soon too.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's been a pleasure as always. And yeah, very much looking forward to coming back on in the not too distant future.
Excellent. If you're still out there, then thank you for listening to the podcast, to the Today's Football Times. And we'll be back again around about 7 days from now. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.